Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Can you hear me, first of all?
Yes.
Good. If I tail off, let me know. It's very nerve-wracking indeed to be standing in front of friends and neighbours and talking, but I'll do my best. And I've got a really rather wonderful subject to talk about, which is why when there was discussion about a series of events in the church, I glibly said, oh, I'll do a talk on Henry Blois. Quite a lot of research later, hopefully it's done, and he is, fortunately, as interesting as I thought he was, and therefore I have got something to say. But actually, also before I start, I think that we should say thank you to the organisers, Katie and Jane, and also to the remarkable technical team, Matt and David, who constructed this fantastic screen, especially for tonight. All reversible, no damage will be done to the church. And to Leo Seymour, who's also been involved as well. So thank you very much. And their assistance has certainly meant that my nerves have been a great deal calmer than they would have been otherwise. No problem has proved insurmountable thus far. Well, so now to the subject in hand. This is him on the screen, and I'll talk more about this particular object later. But first I'll start with actually what was said about him. He was described as that old deceiver of Winchester, and a new kind of monster, part pure and part corrupt. Those were contemporary assessments of Henry by two of his many enemies. So bear that in mind, there were enemies. But he himself described himself as England's relying upon him both for peace and for war. So that sets a scene, actually, about what an extraordinarily significant figure he was, the builder of the church that we are in today. But who was he, and why was he so significant? Well, he was Bishop of Winchester for over 40 years. He was England's richest man. And yet, by the time he died, he had given away almost all his wealth. He was the maker of kings, and he was the builder of palaces and churches, once again including where we are now. He was very learned and articulate, he was an extraordinary patron of the arts, and all of these aspects I'm going to touch upon. He was born, probably, we don't know for certain exact year, but probably in 1096. He was the son of Étienne, Count of Blois, hence he's Henry of Blois, and Étienne's wife, who was Princess Adela of England. She was the daughter of William the Conqueror. Therefore, our Henry was the grandson of the Conqueror and the nephew of the successive kings, William Rufus and Henry I. Because of his royal birth, and because he was the fourth son, his three elder brothers were destined to be warriors and leaders, but he was intended for the church, and being a very elevated birth, the place for the child of a monarch or great noble to go was Cluny in Burgundy, and some of you may have been here. You'll recognise it like this, as we'll see in a minute, but this was one of the richest and most important monasteries in Europe, supported by many kings and other rulers. And when Henry was there, this great church was being rebuilt. And by the time it was finished, during his lifetime, it was the largest building in Europe. And it remained so until the 16th century rebuilding of St. Peter's in Rome. It's a really extraordinary structure. And to give you an idea of how big it was, it stretched from here to the shop. So if you compare it to where we are now, that shows you how vast it was. Unfortunately, it survived until the French Revolution and was then almost completely torn down. And the only element that survives is that small fragment of the south transept that you can see there, which is on the drawing, is on the left-hand side beyond the crossing tower. Cluny was highly influential to Henry of Blois. It set him up for his career as an ecclesiastic, and indeed as senior ecclesiastics were in the Middle Ages, also statesmen, because the Clunian order very much believed in a mix between church and state, and was rather more earthly than the opposing Cistercian order. And on top of that, it also believed in the ornamentation of its buildings, both in the structures themselves and the artifacts within, and in the books that were associated with them, and we'll be talking about a very significant book related to Henry Blois later. So, and another key fact about it was that it was probably the greatest building in the architectural style known as the Romanesque. And I'll just explain what the Romanesque is. The basic characteristic of the Romanesque style is fortunately depicted behind me. It's the style of the round arch. And it's known as Romanesque because it was an evolution from the Roman. So that's the basic summing up of it. It was the first real flourishing in architecture after the Roman period. And England very much led the way, but prompted by what had been going on the continent, including at Cluny. It was predominant in the 11th and 12th centuries, so at the time of the conquest and through to the end of the subsequent century. It was succeeded by the Gothic, and what distinguishes the Gothic is the pointed arch, which we have here. So I didn't need slides for these, fortunately, because we had the examples. And just if you look at this building, the south arch is later, therefore there would have been a solid wall there. And by the organ, you can see one of the surviving Romanesque windows at the back. Simple, small, and round-headed. Very different to later when you get much larger areas of glass. And that the Romanesque style is often referred to in England as the Norman style, but that's very specific to England rather than on the continent generally. In terms of decoration, the Romanesque was something very strong lines, as again you see here, and bold ornamentation. As on the south and west doors of this church, and here's the west door, and I could treat you all outside and looked at it, but thought maybe it's better if I show it on the screen. And the moulding you can see in the middle range there is known as the zigzag moulding. It's very, very simple. Once you get to the Gothic, then you tend to get much more sort of florid carving and more true to nature, so looking like twisting leaves and so forth. So that's the Romanesque, and also it's a time of where ornamentation was of high relief, so deeply carved, as on our wonderful Tournai marble font, which actually is George Atkinson pointed out that he and many members of his family have been christened in, because I wasn't thinking about that when I was writing, but many of you in here might have been christened in that font. It's a great thought. but I'll be talking much more about that later. Henry of Blois arrived in England in the early 1120s. He was brought over by, probably with his brother Stephen, by their uncle, King Henry I of England. And a bit of a warning here, there are an awful lot of Henrys in this story, so I will try to always refer to Henry of Blois as Henry of Blois, because otherwise it gets terribly complicated. Anyway, so they were brought over, and Henry I, the king, was a great patron of Cluny himself, and also saw his nephews, Stephen and Henry, as being great supporters of his. When Henry Grant first came over, he was probably appointed to be the prior of the Cluniac monastery of Montacute in Somerset. Nothing of his time survives, and this is the main survival there, which is a much later gatehouse, but actually of the priory. But in 1126, very shortly after he'd gone to Montacute, he was, through the influence of the king, he was raised to be abbot of the richest abbey, or monastery rather, in the country, Glastonbury. And he's known whilst he was there to have done a great deal of building, but sadly there was a very dramatic fire in 1184 after his death, which destroyed everything he'd done. And this is the Lady Chapel, which was built in the Romanesque style, as you can see, because of the wrapped arches, after his death. Fortunately, there are some fragments of the work that he undertook, and here's a reconstruction using some of those fragments of the cloister that we had built at Glastonbury. And you can see these wonderful carved capitals, very much in that very bold style of the Romanesque. He'd only been abbot of Glastonbury, the richest monastery in Britain, for 3 years when he was advanced to be was consecrated as Bishop of Winchester in 1129. Winchester was the richest diocese in England. So he had he was abbot of Glastonbury, and he then became Bishop of Winchester. And this is a map showing the diocese of Winchester. Some of us were talking about this before the talk, as it was before the 19th century. And essentially, it's Hampshire, the Isle of Wight, and Surrey. At some point, Guernsey was also a part of the diocese. So that shows you it, and the diocese of Salisbury immediately next door. But it's stretching right up, and you can make it out. At the very top, it says, in capital letters, London. So it goes right up to London, the diocese. And it had enormous estates. And this is a map showing the estates of the bishop. You might notice that they're not just within the diocese either. They go as far west as Taunton and as far north as Adderbury in Oxfordshire. He was undoubtedly, or almost undoubtedly, I'll say for certain, but the richest man in the kingdom. And you might think it's odd, when he moved from Glastonbury, did he not give up the abbey? Well, he didn't wish to, and it had a very substantial income, so he remained in both. That's known as pluralism, which was frowned upon, but was not actually banned until after his death. And even then, if you had influence, you could actually get round to the regulations, and that's one of the reasons for the Reformation in the 16th century. And it's these estates that bring us to look to East Meon, because East Meon and Taunton were the two richest estates of the Diocese of Winchester. Although he did not actually have control of East Meon when he became bishop. It was granted to him in 1136, so shortly afterwards. We'll return to East Meon later, but before we do so, just wanted to outline Henry's really rather remarkable political career. And we start with a tragedy. Henry I of England, seeing him looking very sad, because his only son, William, was drowned on journey from Normandy to England in 1120, and on what is famously known as the White Ship. There were 300 aboard, a substantial number, and they had been drinking heavily before they set out for Normandy, including the crew. And as a consequence, the ship was recklessly driven onto rocks, and everybody drowned apart from one man, who is recorded as being a butcher from Rouen. But everybody else drowned, including Henry's son, only son, William. Fortunately for him, Stephen, who was the next heir in a way, or next male heir, had a bout of diarrhea just before the ship was about to set off and didn't get on it, so he survived. But Henry was then, he had a quandary. He married again very soon after this. He was a widower at the time of the tragedy, but had no more children. And in 1126, he decided to do something for them very remarkable and make his daughter, his only surviving child, Matilda, his heir. And to ensure that she succeeded, he asked all his nobles and great churchmen to swear allegiance to Matilda, which Henry of Blois and his brother Stephen both did. However, when Henry died in 1135, Henry of Blois decided to do all he could to get his brother Stephen on the throne instead of Matilda. And don't feel too sorry for Matilda, because at that time she was in Normandy fighting her father. So they're a pretty ruthless lot, all of these people. Henry I himself was seized of the throne, and it wasn't really his rightfully. Henry of Blois got all the great nobles in England behind him, and he also made promises on behalf of Stephen to the church that the monarch would not interfere in church affairs. This is a very important principle in medieval England, and hence all the hoo-ha over Thomas Becket later on. Stephen, who actually at that time had been in Boulogne, got across very quickly to England and was crowned King of England at Canterbury on the 22nd of December 1135, just 3 weeks after Henry I died. So his brother, Henry of Blois, had achieved a fait accompli, a coup d'etat, essentially, and got Stephen on the throne, and that was solidified when the chief arbiter of Europe in the Middle Ages, the Pope, recognised Stephen as king. So, all well for the moment. However, there were many supporters for Matilda, and they soon took up arms against Stephen, and civil war broke out. A civil war that lasted for a very long time, for over 20 years, and nearly 20 years, big problem, was known as the Anarchy because it was so devastating to the country. Stephen, to try to improve his position of authority, imprisoned the bishops of Salisbury, Lincoln, and Ely, and then dashed to Salisbury to seize the Bishop of Salisbury's treasure. His brother Henry was not very happy about this because he had made promises on Stephen's behalf that the independence of the church would be respected. However, he tried to keep the peace, and when Matilda landed in England in 1139, Henry negotiated for her to have safe passage to meet her half-brother at Bristol and accompanied her himself through his diocese. And here she is looking rather glum. she might have a different time for it, I think. She certainly doesn't look terribly well. So he did that, and he continued to try to keep the peace the following year. But in early 1141, at the Battle of Lincoln, between Matilda's and Stephen's forces, Stephen lost, and he was imprisoned. and Henry of Blois, being ever the pragmatist, abandoned his brother and supported Matilda, who he recognised essentially as Queen of England, or his, as he termed it, the Lady of the English. Unfortunately, Matilda was not a great diplomat, and she promptly fell out of the Citizens of London, presumably the more senior Citizens of London, and was thrown out of London, and made her way to Winchester, where Henry of Blois, it's stated by a contemporary account, as Matilda went in one by one gate, Henry of Blois went out by the other, and he then took up arms again for his brother, Stephen. I'm sorry, it's terribly complicated, but it is very important in terms of Henry's role at this time. And indeed, in due course, Stephen was put back on the throne again. That, though, did not end the Civil War, which carried on for another 12 years until 1153, pretty much stalemate. One of the key areas that was maintained for the king was the Diocese of Winchester because of Henry. But in 1153, Henry Blois was critical to the negotiation of a peace by which Matilda's son, Henry of Anjou, would succeed Stephen as king when he died. And that peace was sealed by a kiss of peace in Winchester Cathedral, and the treaty was known as the Treaty of Winchester. So that is a gallop through, and probably horribly confusing, but in summary, Henry of Blois had been responsible for making his brother king. He was then responsible for dethroning him and bringing Matilda, in theory, to the throne, though she's not really recognised as reigning, then putting his brother back on the throne again, and finally for bringing an end to the terrible civil war that had been raging for so long in the country. So you can see what a remarkable figure he was in the history of England. When Henry II succeeded, obviously the son of his former enemy, Matilda, he was not persecuted, but he felt unsafe, and he went into voluntary exile for a while at Cluny. And then when he came back in the 1150s, late 1150s, he was not such a powerful figure anymore, and concentrated really on his diocese and estates. But he did come out into the spotlight once again in 1162, when he was responsible for overseeing the consecration of Thomas Becket as Archbishop of Canterbury, and will be returned to Thomas Becket later. So that's a run through of Henry of Blois, the main events of his life, and I'll now turn to him as a builder and as a patron of the arts. And I've already touched on his works at Glastonbury, and briefly to say that he built an enormous palace at Southwark, when he was attending to business in London, which as a major figure in the court he needed to do. And there is still a fragment surviving of Winchester Palace in London. Many of the bishops had palaces in London, but his was the largest of them all. And this is a fragment of the Great Hall, actually of a later rebuilding than Henry. But his palace was not only the largest amongst bishops, but one of the largest buildings in medieval London. And another aspect that came with owning Southwark was that there were two areas in London where prostitution was tolerated. One of them was Southwark. So Henry of Blois received rents from brothels as part of his great wealth. And that continued with bishops of Winchester in the medieval period and resulted in prostitutes in London being known as Winchester geese. So if you hear reference to Winchester geese, it's not the feathered kind. Nearer to, and so nothing of his time survives there, other than the name. Nearer to home, there is much more surviving. Winchester Cathedral itself had only recently been rebuilt, a great Romanesque reconstruction. But Henry did make one significant addition, which is symptomatic of his own wealth and the wealth of the diocese. He added a treasury in the south transept, which is still there, and includes these rather wonderful underground sort of caverns for keeping of the treasure. And he also rearranged the bodies, or reinterred and rearranged the bodies of the early English kings, because Winchester was the burial place for all the early kings, from Alfred the Great until William Rufus, so just after the conquest as well. These are actually 16th century chests, but they're probably in very similar arrangement to as put up by Henry Blois. They include King Canute, Hardy Canute, and as I said, William Rufus. There's been a lot of archaeological work going on in recent years to try and identify exactly who is in the different chests, and that's partly necessary because after the Battle of Cheriton in 1644, the Parliamentarian soldiers ransacked the cathedral and broke into two of the chests and used some of the boats, presumably the longer ones, to smash the stained glass in the cathedral. And though the bones were recovered and put back in the chest, they weren't necessarily put in the right ones. So that was a bit of a dilemma. Just to the south of Winchester, Henry founded the Hospital of St. Cross, which was an almshouse for 13 aged brethren and the feeding of 100 poor people daily. And I'm sure many of you have been to St. Cross. If you haven't, you must go, because it is the most wonderful place and still is an operating hospital. And you'll know that still to this day, they give out a wayfarer's dole of beer and bread. Not enough to keep you going for very long, but nevertheless, the custom keeps going. The domestic buildings, and you can see with the series of chimneys behind and the gatehouse, are 14th and 15th century, but the bulk of the church was constructed in the later years of Henry of Blois, and is a very fine example of Romanesque architecture, with an aisled cross plan and round arches, and this very bold ornamentation of ribs and window surrounds, particularly the Lady Chapel, which is on the right-hand side. Henry also embellished and rebuilt churches associated with his estates, and those included Bishop's Waltham, although there's virtually nothing there now. You can see all the church that he constructed. Bishop's Sutton, where there's more, but last, but very definitely, most importantly, here. Here we are. When the lights were on. And East Meon, although the current building was commenced whilst actually the parish was under royal control in the very late 11th century or early 12th, it's now generally agreed that Henry of Blois was responsible for the magnificent tower. With this, and I should have actually said that on, if you see on the gable end, which is the east facade of the church, you can see those round windows at the top, or oculi is a technical term for them. These are very much a distinctive feature of Henry's architecture, and we have them here. Now, there should be a series of three on each face, And obviously three of them on three faces are covered by the clock, but there they are, with the tripartite round-headed windows below, with zigzag and dental mouldings on them, to give you the technical descriptions. This is an exceptionally fine piece of architecture. It's probably the most accomplished and sophisticated pieces of Norman architecture in any parish church in England. So it's something to be immensely proud of. The original plan to, I've mentioned earlier that you wouldn't have had South Aisle, wouldn't have had the Lady Chapel, is a very simple cross, and the best of Norman buildings are made all the more effective by the simplicity of their plans. And ornamentation being primarily focused on the tower and on the west and south doors. The south door has been shifted southwards when the aisle was added. Now, again, debate about were these Henry of Blois' work. My thinking is that they were, because churches were almost invariably built from the east end westwards. You needed to tertiary to have the working bit going first of all, and therefore these would have been done quite late on. Therefore, it's highly likely that if he did the tower, he would have done the two doors as well. Now, the reason for each of these three churches that I've mentioned, so Bishop's Waltham, Bishop Sutton, and here, being focused on by Henry, was because he had estates in each of those places, and in each of those places there was also a hunting park, and that's why the church here is built up against what is now known as Park Hill. And so he was resident, at least in part of the year, he would be here. So he wanted the church to be impressive. And here we have, again, the church, but also showing the courthouse, which is the very significant remnant of William of Wykeham's bishop's palace, or bishop's house, or manor house. And at Bishop Sutton, there was also a building, a house. We don't know, at least Jordan probably will be able to correct me if I'm wrong, don't think we know the form of the building before William of Wykeham's house. There are theories about it. There certainly appears to have been a bishop's house here in the Norman period. And Bishop Sutton too, though that's pretty much entirely disappeared, it recently, a scholar of Henry Blyth called Nicholas Ryle, suggested that this may be a drawing showing the palace at Bishop Sutton. But both Eastmere and Bishop Sutton, the houses that they were there, were not really palaces. They were manor houses, and they would act as hunting lodges and as administrative centres for the estates. Whereas at Bishop's Waltham, I'm sure again many of you will have been there, you'll know if you've visited how vast this is. Even the scale of the ruin is vast. And this was a fully functioning and enormous palace that was sufficiently big that it could house the royal court when they visited in 1182, and on many occasions subsequently, including when Queen Mary met Philip II of Spain before her marriage. Henry, after he came back from exile, built this enormous place, and although it's in ruins now, this is a reconstruction done by Historic England to give you an idea of its appearance much later on, but the substantial stone bits, the structure of most of that was Henry of Blois, although because it was the Bishop of Winchester's principal country palace, it was constantly updated, and there's very little Romanesque detail actually evident now. Fortunately, there are some fragments, and I don't know if anybody has visited the very charming museum in the palace grounds of Bishop's Waltham. It's well worth it if you haven't. And the fragments are in there, and again from reconstruction, they show a very similar door to the west door here as part of what he undertook at Bishop's Waltham. Henry Bois's town palace was Wolsey, next to the cathedral. And you can see here, on the two plans on the left, how he's massively increased the size of the house, more than doubling it during his life. And also the sheer scale is given by this aerial view when you compare it to the cathedral, although admittedly, because of the angle, it does emphasize that even more. But nevertheless, it was enormous. And once again, sadly, it's ruined, but a reconstruction has been done, including of the hall, and you can see again the use of the oculi, the round windows within that. Wolsey had a moat and a defensive wall added at the beginning of the Civil War, prudently. Henry Bois also created magnificent gardens there and built a menagerie. So it was quite some establishment. He also made very innovative use of materials, Tournai marble, which we'll be talking about at the front here, and Purbeck marble, and some very fine carving. An example of a fragment of surviving carving from his time is this door jamb. You see a very beautiful ornamented carving with a creature peeping out amongst the scrolling foliage. And that brings us to the subject of Tournai marble, because in Hampshire there are four Tournai marble fonts: St. Michael's Southampton, St. Mary Bourne, and Winchester Cathedral. And all of them are mid-12th century, and it's possible that Henry of Blois was responsible for commissioning all of them. I mean, to my mind, there is such a clear similarity between the Winchester one on the right and ours, that and both of those places he had that very direct connection, that those must be him. I'm not so sure about the other ones because they're very different stylistically. And he set a trend for it, and there are four in Hampshire and there are six in other parts of the country. It's a very short-lived trend. There's much discussion about whether they were carved here or at Tournai, which is in modern-day Belgium. Well, it's almost impossible to say for certain. The stone does become much harder with age, and of course there would be less of it to transport if you did the carving elsewhere. But then I get the impression that Henry was very concerned about exactly how things were done and would have wanted to know. And there is a record of a guild of Tournai craftsmen in Winchester, so they may have been carved there. And because I know there are many sailing folk in the audience, I must point out at this point, and I have to read it because it means nothing to me, that the Winchester font on the right-hand side includes, you can see that boat. It's the earliest depiction of a boat with a stern post rudder. So you sailing folk, when you go to Winchester, you must go and look at that and bow down in appreciation. The Winchester font shows the life of St. Nicholas, and ours shows the story of Adam and Eve, going from the right to the left, and also actually including the other sides, but they're just really about the sort of creation of the earth and the produce of the earth, and then Adam and Eve making an appearance on the third side. But it took me nearly 10 years to work out with a special light for the font. So I would bring guests staying in here and talk about it and dinge. And then one of my friends who I was with said, "What does this do?" And press it. Ah, you can see it. It's very effective. So wherever it's carved, it's certain that the carvers themselves were from Tournai because of the style of the carving, which is very bold but stiffer and less refined than the indigenous carvers were producing for Henry, such as that door jamb I showed you at Wolsey. Not only did Henry's Winchester attract best craftsmen, from the continent. He also travelled much as well, the continent, many times, relatively large number of times, primarily to Rome and Cluny, but he was also thought to have travelled across Spain. And we have a contemporary account of him visiting Rome from John of Salisbury, Bishop of Chartres. And John of Salisbury teased him for having Damasippus's craze, which of course we all know what that is. Damasippus is a character in the writings of Horace who ruined himself by obsessively buying antiques. Well, Henry certainly didn't ruin himself because he had plenty of money, but he did buy, and again, John sort of recalls he bought antique Roman sculptures. That's quite a brave thing for a cleric to do because they're heathen. Therefore, he was rather bucking the trend, as he did in other ways as well. None of that sculpture is known to Spike. It may do, but we don't, it hasn't been identified. But what we do have is carving that was done for Henry for Wolsey Palace and elsewhere that shows classical influence. And this is a particularly important piece, which has a capital that has a centaur on one side and a griffin on the other, which are undoubtedly of classical inspiration. And also, we don't have his intaglio, which means incised stone seal, but we do have the impression of it. And this is showing the gods Zeus and Isis. So this was a Roman intaglio stone that Henry would have bought in Rome and then used as, this is his counter seal actually, and therefore we have that direct evidence of him collecting items whilst he was in Rome. And now we come back to the image that was on the screen at the very start of the talk. And Henry is probably carrying a slab made up of Roman marbles, perhaps as an altar, so he's giving an offering, he's bowing down. But this plaque was one of two surviving. But it would have been intended to adorn a large crucifix. And you can see here a reconstruction showing how there would have been four originally on the ends of a crucifix. And as well as showing Henry, this would have been made, although it's made actually copper with enamel, it would have been made by a goldsmith because it needed the finest of workmanship to produce it. And it's from this school known as the Mosen School, that's the Meurs Valley in Belgium. And once again, they're known to have been Mosen craftsmen working in Winchester. Winchester was an absolute cultural hive of activity at this time, thanks to Henry of Blois. It would have been absolutely festooned in gold originally. You can see little fragments surviving by his feet. But that's sadly all gone. Henry is known to have commissioned huge quantities of items in gold and silver from his legacies he left to Mr. Cluny and elsewhere. And undoubtedly, there would have been wonderful pieces of gold and silver here. Maybe they're buried somewhere, you never know. But they certainly don't survive as far as we know now. And in fact, what we do know about his commissioning is that he gave 500 ounces of gold to the abbot of Cluny to create an enormous crucifix, and the gold would have been in plates that would have been pinned to a timber core. 500 ounces of gold is today worth £700,000. So that gives you a sense of the scale of Henry's patronage. And gold today is worth much less comparatively than it would have been in the 12th century. So that's even more remarkable. That's one of his gifts that's recorded during his life. One piece of silver that we know absolutely Eastmian Church would have had, thanks to Henry, is a silver chalice. Very little survived of 12th century church silver. This is actually gilded copper. And even Guild's Copper is very aggressive by this. Comes originally from Gloucester Cathedral, went to France and then ended up in the V&A. But there's very little. But now going on to the chalice, so this is a contemporary chalice from Henry Blois' time, but actually from Canterbury Cathedral. But Henry was horrified to find that many of the churches in his diocese had no silver, and particularly had no silver chalices, which was considered to be irreverent. They were latten, which was a sort of copper and tin, I think, alloy. So he decided to do something about this, and he did something about it by making all his parishes pay the 12th century equivalent of the parish share in the form of a silver chalice. So every church had to pay him with one of these. As soon as he got them, he gave them back to the churches again for use in the churches. Because he was just giving them the money to make them. Well, not all of them would have done so. So it was very clever and very, indeed very enlightened and generous act by him. And perhaps the modern church wouldn't make quite such a generous act as that. Maybe. Anyway, they did. Now, there are probably only about a dozen surviving Norman chalices, and almost all of them were actually grave goods. This was buried with an Archbishop of Canterbury, who was Archbishop Walter's chalice. Because silver and gold were money. They were the same as the coinage. If you fell on hard times, you would send your gold in and silver into a goldsmith, who'd melt it down and give it back to you, essentially, as coins. And that happened a lot. And also, if fashions changed, you'd send your silver in to be melted and made into something in the new fashion. Therefore, there are a minuscule number of pieces of silver from this period surviving, which this only survived because it was in a grave for 600 years. And unfortunately, whereas the wrecker's ball, which certainly did for many of Henry's buildings, leaves fragments, as I've shown you, the melting pot is rather more complete in its destruction. So there's very, very little surviving. And returning back again to this Mosin plaque, another thing that's very remarkable about this is that it's a portrait of Henry, and a contemporary portrait of Henry, by somebody who probably met him and knew what he looked like. And I can't emphasize how significant that is, because all the other characters in the story that I've shown you are later depictions and imaginary. This is as close as you get at the time to a portrait. And notice that very distinct beard that he's got. That is really unusual, because it was considered inappropriate for clergy to have beards and long hair. He has got a tonsure, you can see above, but this beard is very striking. And it was actually commented upon by John Salisbury, who said that he was noticeable for his long beard and his philosophical solemnity. Now, that says something else about Henry as well, because he was prepared to do something he shouldn't really have done, and he could do that because he was so powerful. But it also shows that he was a man of fashion. In the 11th century, it was absolutely forbidden for knights and churchmen to have long hair and beards. Courtiers in the early 11th century, it became very fashionable, still frowned upon by the older generation, but very fashionable. But Henry followed that fashion. So he isn't just a stodgy churchman, he's also a follower of fashion, and indeed a leader of fashion in his use of architectural materials. And there are more contemporary depictions of Henry. This is from his principal seal, also surviving at Winchester College. And his most perfectly preserved and significant survival from his time, the Winchester Bible. And this is Henry depicted as Pope Desiderius in the Winchester Bible. This is a very, very remarkable object indeed, which I'm pretty sure is now on display in the cathedral. I haven't been, obviously, for quite a long time, but when I last went, I'm pretty sure it was. This shows you how big it is. just getting a sense of his hands, that each page is 2 foot by 1.5 feet. It's the largest surviving 12th century Bible, and one of the most lavishly illustrated. It is, in essence, a picture gallery in itself, because of these fantastic illuminated initials. And it was produced in Winchester. There was a famous scriptorium in Winchester by the monks. One single scribe did all the lettering, but an analysis by experts of the illuminated initials shows that they were done by 6 different artists. And this just shows you how superb they are, but actually also what an extraordinarily expensive production this was. Because not only do you have gold, but you have the blue for which you need lapis lazuli, which is only available from Afghanistan, and was much more expensive, I told you how expensive gold was, than gold. And I'm just going to, also, this remarkable object was produced for Winchester Cathedral by Henry, and it has stayed at Winchester ever since, which is really remarkable. I mean, it did go to London for a couple of years in 1650, but we can forgive it that. The number of portable items in churches in this country that you could say have stayed there for that long, you can probably count them on the fingers of one hand. So this is a very remarkable thing indeed. And I'm just going to read actually some of the words of the great authority on the Winchester Bible, Claire Donovan, because I can't do better than her description. She says, "The consistently marvellous quality of the painting and gilding catches your breath as you turn to an opening to find a great, shiny, high-coloured, storytelling initial, stylish and full of vitality." And here are a few examples of those wonderful initials. And you can see, such, you know, there'll be a sort of monster's head grabbing a ball here. The details on them are absolutely superb. And a number of these you can see online as well. When I was putting this slide together, I suddenly noticed that there was an F and a U, and so I had to be a bit careful about my arrangement of the letters when I was putting it together. And it also occurred to me that you could have an extremely grand poison pen letter using these illuminated initials. Of course, if one comes like that's me, but. Henry was also able to saw the creation of many other books, and this is his Psalter, or Book of Psalms, which survives in the British Library. Rather cruder illuminations, but notice lots of prominent beards again, and this fantastic depiction of hell on the right-hand side. And to put the fear of God into those who are looking at it. And then the other really important book associated with Henry of Blois is the Survey of Winchester, which had been started by Henry I in 1110 and was completed by Henry of Blois in 1148. Has its original binding. This is a detail of it. You see these wonderful stamped deer and wolves and exotic birds on it. And it's actually the earliest and most detailed record of a European city to survive. So another very remarkable item indeed is the Manus Society of Antiquaries in London. And I'm showing you here the first page of Henry's survey with a translation. It's a bit easier in a translation. And as any good survey should, it starts by laying out questions at the very top. And it says that the questions were, what is the name of the landholder? How much does he hold? From whom does he hold it? And how much does each person receive from the land? And then it goes on, it starts with the high street. None of your Marx and Spencer and Graves at that time. And actually what is very wonderful about the Winton Doomsday, is his name, I should say before I go on to that, there was no doomsday survey of Winchester or London in the main doomsday in 1086. So this was catching up, in a way, is more detailed. But one particularly wonderful thing is the recording of names. And you have the personal, first Christian names given, and then you have the sort of the origins of surnames, and you have, and they're by four categories really, thereby the place of origin, the parentage, employment, and nicknames. And you have here, so Richard of Bayer, number seven, and Godfrey's son William, so that's the second category. And then over here you have got, well, various ones, but Richard the Needlemaker. And then in terms of nicknames, you have Robert the Weasel. Now, would you frequent a shop in the high street in Worcester run by Robert the Weasel? It made me rather think of Auntie Wainwright's shop in Last of the Summer Wine. I think it put me off, certainly. And then also, what about Hugh Hackmouse? Well, maybe he was the 12th century equivalent of Rentokil.
Yes.
I don't know. So this extraordinary survey exemplifies the excellent administrative skills of Henry of Blois. It's just another example of what an important role he played in the history not only of this parish and this county, but of the country as a whole. And he was having to walk a precarious tightrope in the most turbulent of times, but he survived throughout it and died in his own bed in 1171 after over 40 years, as I mentioned earlier, as Bishop of Winchester. And, as I said also at the beginning, by that time he was no longer the wealthiest man in the country because he'd given away most of his wealth. Now, that wasn't entirely altruistic, because had he kept it, as soon as he died, the king would have taken it. So, therefore, he got it as quickly as he could before he died. In his life, he'd been responsible, you could say, his critics accused him of greed for power and wealth. Well, yes, but then most churchmen at that time were like that, so it was hardly unusual. And he was very principled and courageous in defending the rights of the independence of the church, and he gave away his wealth. So it's much more of a mixed story than you get by just looking at the accounts of his enemies. And he was respectable, be it he every now and again would put somebody on the throne and take another person on. He did bring that horrendous civil war to an end. And finally, it was to him on his deathbed that King Henry II came after the murder of Thomas Becket to seek advice on what to do. And it's recorded that Henry of Blois did not hold back in admonishing the king. 2 days after the king's visit, on August the 8th, 1171, Henry of Blois died, and he was buried in Winchester Cathedral. So that's just a repeat of the various images of him, which is remarkable itself to have three images of him from his lifetime. And was buried in Winchester Cathedral, and probably in this tomb, which is in the choir of limestone and Purbeck marble, although it's also claimed for William Rufus, but actually the fact that it, when the tomb was opened, it contained a chalice, which you would get buried with a priest, would suggest it's very likely that it is Henry of Blois. His memory lives on in East Meon, thanks to this magnificent building and that wonderful font. And now I won't ever be able to look at it again without thinking of some of you who I know being dangled over it as babies. And these are truly great treasures that we should nurture and celebrate. Thank you very much.